it's beyond dysfunctional and broken. And I think they just stuck to their political ideology and just chose to ignore us. And I'll tell you, I'll be very clear, lots and lots and lots of Albertans have died because of that.
Forgotten Corner podcast would not exist without our listeners. If you enjoy the work we are doing on this show and would like to support further, please consider a donation through our Patreon account, patreon.com/forgottencornerpod, or visit our website, forgottencornerpod.com. Welcome back to the Forgotten Corner podcast. We acknowledge that the Forgotten Corner occupies unceded Indigenous land. We acknowledge that the Blackfoot Confederacy never surrendered their land in the signing of Treaty 7, but agreed to share it. The Forgotten Corner sits on Treaty 7 and Treaty 4 territory, traditional lands of the Siksika, Kainai, Piikani, Stony Nakoda, Tsuut'ina, as well as the Cree, Sioux, and Soto bands of the Ojibwa peoples. We also honor and acknowledge that we are on the Métis Nation within Region 3. Forgotten Corner is proud members of the Harbinger Media Network. If you like listening to progressive podcasts such as this, you can find plenty more on the website that we always provide in our show notes. My name is Scott Schmidt. I am your co-host and good friend of my co-host, Jeremy Appel. Mr. Appel, welcome. How are you today, buddy?
I'm doing pretty well. Pretty well. I see, I was looking at polls for the Calgary election this week, and yeah, it looks like our guest from last week got the Forgotten Corner bump.
Is that right? Yeah. You said that. Jody got a big, probably 2 or 3 points easy in the polls,
which can be directly attributed to her interview on the show 100%. That she didn't retweet.
Which she didn't. Yeah, we never get that from the big from those ones. Yeah. I don't think then she promoted her show. Well, and then they get off and they're like, fuck, I don't want anyone to hear that.
Yeah, well, and then she at the time wasn't using Twitter a lot. He's back on now. But yeah, I'm sure Stephen Carter told her, like, don't give those fucks a reason.
He doesn't like us. Let's face that.
No, yeah, I mean, I've been really rude to him online. He did unblock me for the second time.
Fantastic. I have never been rude to him, and he blocked me. And he's
it's probably because of your association with me.
I guess. I don't know. I don't care. Like those guys, I mean, that there's that certain group of them. I mean, we don't have to talk about it on our show, but I could give two shits what Stephen Carter thinks of us or how we do things. Cause I think our entire MO is that, like, however things have been done for the last number of decades it's time to change. And so I'm personally tired of hearing about people that have all this experience in the political world and how we should keep listening to them. Cause we're trying to change the political world. We're not trying to, work within the same parameters that we've always seen, right? So anyway, quick update on my mom and dad. They're both doing good. My mom is here, gonna be a little longer in the hospital. She has to get a collarbone surgery still. So they weren't too, let's just say the local surgeon here isn't too pumped that they didn't fix that in Kamloops, but hopefully she can actually, I don't know, maybe our guest today can tell us how much different bone surgery is to maybe some of the other ones, because my dad's going to need a knee surgery, but I'm guessing he's going to wait a while, whereas mom might get in a little sooner because bones tend to heal, whether if you stop, you don't fix them, and we don't want that going the wrong way. Nonetheless, they're doing really good spirits. Gonna suck not having mom for Thanksgiving supper, but we'll set her a place. And we'll probably do a big FaceTime like scenario with her from the hospital. So it'll be pretty cool. Yeah. So anyway, do you want to get into our guest today? Cause he's really like sitting here patiently waiting, and also really nice to give us any time at all in considering what he's probably dealing with in his career these days.
Let's start the show.
Absolutely. All right. He is the head of the emergency medicine for the Alberta Medical Association and a longtime ER doctor from right here in the Forgotten Corner. Dr. Paul Parks is a name that has appeared in the pages of the Medicine Hat News and publications around the province for many times over the years for many different reasons. But these days, he's become one of the household warriors in the fight against COVID-19 and maybe more notably, the fight to get our provincial government to fight against COVID-19. The Forgotten Corner is extremely pleased to have Dr. Parks with us this week and grateful he was able to fit us in during what is no doubt the most chaotic time of his medical career. We have a ton we hope to discuss with him today, so let's get right to it. Dr. Parks, welcome to the Forgotten Corner.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for having me, guys. Yeah, hopefully this will be useful for your listeners out there. We can get the word out.
100% it will be. And we've talked about this show quite a bit, or this topic on our show quite a bit, but it's really nice to have somebody from right here in Medicine Hat that we can talk to. And obviously your name has been popping up more now, maybe than ever. So we don't really have to tell guests why we brought you here, but let's tell guests a little bit about who you are. Where are you from originally?
So, all over Canada, because I grew up my military brat. So my dad was in the forces. So I actually was all over in Ontario, BC, but actually did graduate high school from big old Cold Lake, Alberta, actually. So that's where I graduated there. And then probably would consider Edmonton would have been probably where most of my roots, because I did undergrad there and spent some time there. Did med school down in Kingston and then came back to Edmonton to do my eMERGE training residency. Was there working at the U of A for a while. And then now I've been down in the big old hat for almost going on 13 years now. So actually, to be honest, the hat's probably the one place I've been the longest now.
The longest
in my life. So,
well, yeah. I've been at the newspaper now for 11 years. And for that entire time, your name has been at one point or another popping in and out of the paper, whether it be queue jumping or anything else that's come up along the years. Why medicine when you decided to, what made you want to become a doctor?
I think part of it was an interest in medicine and science itself is why I was studying. But then kind of early on, I realized that I was actually kind of pretty attracted to the kind of chaos and the difference of eMERGE medicine pretty early too. So, obviously I think my track record for being an advocate around public health and publicly funded healthcare, and I've always had a very strong interest in that kind of piece right from the get-go around protecting marginalized populations and helping people that need help. So, you know, in the end, I tell my kids now, don't go into medicine to be a doctor, to be rich. Don't be a doctor to be rich. Go in if it's a calling and it's something you want to do to help people, because there's way easier ways to get rich than to do medicine.
Well, and probably the chaos that you were yearning for going into med school, did you imagine the chaos being anything close to the chaos that has been the last 19 months? Is there any regrets about yearning for chaos at this point?
Well, yeah, no, I wouldn't have pictured this. You know what? eMERGE is kind of like organized chaos. So we have a bit of organization to it. But I think if I were to say that the Alberta approach to this pandemic has been disorganized, I think that would be more than kind. So it's not the thing that I was expecting for sure.
Possibly that's the nicest way anybody's put it on this show to date. So appreciate that. We'll start slow and build up. So tell us quickly, how long have you been with the AMA, like as president of the emergency section or whatever the title would be?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, so I've been with AMA pretty much, it's all a bit of a blur, but probably at least around 2010, well, even before that, actually, probably 2007. So pretty even through most of my career, but then intermittently since. So I got quite involved in around 2009 area with all of the access block and overcrowding, and our eMERGE departments were drowning for different reasons back then. Most of it had to do with capacity and long-term care and a bunch of issues like that. So I've been involved. I was on the board of the AMA for a long time, and I've been intermittently the president of the section of eMERGE, which means essentially now I'm the rep for about 450 of us, eMERGE docs across the whole province. So kind of a unified voice for what the issues are for the whole, all the eMERGE docs across the province.
Is that like an elected position within the AMA?
Yep. So, I mean, I was elected to the board for 6 years, and then for my position within the section is an elected position too. And so then we have a rep process and we have an executive and things, but yeah, so I'm kind of, it's an elected position that then kind of officially is the voice of the collective body of eMERGE docs across the province.
So as in all the time that you've been a member of the, or, you know, executive member, I guess, of the AMA, have you ever before our current government been referred to as a special interest group?
No. That's a straight out. I mean, it's a bit bizarre. I'll tell you, you know what's bizarre, even getting to this current government. So one thing I've always said about healthcare advocacy, which I should get out there right away so that nobody, the only reason it's considered healthcare advocacy is considered partisan in politics in any way is because there's always just one party that's running the healthcare system at the time. So whenever there's a government in and they're making decisions, it'll appear that, we're advocating that we're not with that party or we're against their politics or in the end, it's mostly against their policy. But what I would say with this specific government, the most bizarre thing is they have not engaged or wanted our input in any way in the last 20 months or even longer, even before that. I mean, obviously before the pandemic hit, they were fighting with the AMA and the doctors around contracts even, but these guys have not in any way engaged the frontline workers and asked for our opinions and our direction. And it's been devastating and catastrophic, I think.
Yeah, it really has been. We've had Dr. Joe Vipond on the show a couple of times to talk about the response of the government during this.
You heard of him
and whatnot. What's that?
I know Joe well.
I imagine that they know each other intimately well at this point in the pandemic. I mean, doctors speaking out tend to probably flock together a little bit.
We've also had Dr. Jillian Radion. A while back, we had her on a couple times too, as well as Joe. So we are a pro doctor podcast.
We're a pro doctor podcast. Yeah, we the never thought that. I don't think podcast. We ever thought that we'd have to be so pro doctor. Like I think because, and actually, it's actually good that you brought up Jillian because I actually was going to ask you when Jillian was on, and this is going to be a little off topic of what we're here for today. But when Jillian was on, she talked about the fight with doctors that is occurring with the government, and of course, you brought that up. Essentially the opinion of her was that we can have a discussion about monetary compensation. This isn't about trying to it's everything else. It's the disrespect that comes with these talks. Is that how you would probably categorize the relationship with the government, a disrespectful one?
Oh, 100%. I mean, and it's bizarre that we're in a world now where people are declaring they're pro doctor. I mean, even that's bizarre because it's like, what the heck? We're here to help people and advise them regarding their health and trying to keep them safe and healthy. So yeah, I mean, I can see that you can have the debates about are doctors paid too much and all that crap. For sure, you can do that. But to have a schism in society now where there's some people thinking that doctors have nefarious, goals and that we're not actually public good, that we're not trying to help the public is a bit bizarre. So yes, with this government, 100% been disrespectful. And then when the pandemic hit, very much they think they know the answers and they haven't. I could get into details around COVID. Wherever we lead this to, I could give you exact examples of this, but they just have not been receptive in any way to feedback from us as well. Like in terms of saying, hey, if you do this, you're gonna make things 100 times worse. There's not even a connection there.
Well, and in fact, ignorance of it, right? Like going out of their way to look away while the docs are in the media saying hey, this is a big deal. Like as far back as last October, so a year ago now, was when, you know, I don't want to say I give the government a pass on anything, but the first wave of the pandemic, or the first few months of the pandemic, I don't necessarily fault them for going with the we have to live with it approach, and the we'll just wait until they start to decline and then we'll open back up and everything will be fine approach. But once that didn't work, October rolls around, cases are ramping up, doctors start screaming for masks, screaming for all of these things, and it's 6 to 8 weeks later. And now it's a year later, and two or three more times beyond that, the government has had an opportunity to listen to the experts before it gets bad, and then they let it get bad. This last time, they actually got smug about it. They're 0 for 3 going into summer. Experts are 3 for 3. And they're actually now discrediting the experts that haven't gotten it wrong right yet. Like, what would you say, like, if you had to, you know, I know your expertise is medicine, but as a personal citizen of Alberta, like, do you have an opinion on why they might go out of, like, is there something behind why they're choosing to ignore you? Because it's certainly not because they think you're going to be wrong, because the evidence shows that you're going to be right.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that they, so it's really sad how politicized certain things have become. And so somehow it's almost like the truth has become politicized too, in terms of I don't think they wanted to hear what we were going to tell them. And so right away, that didn't fit with their political ideology and where they wanted to go. You know, I'm never going to apologize for these guys, in the sense of that they haven't even let me get at the table to give them some advice as an example, but I get they've got to balance lots of things. I get that they've got to balance enforcement, and they've got to balance, you know, the economy and businesses, and there's lots of pieces that have to go into their decision. But to completely ignore the healthcare input piece. And I'll tell you, so, you know, one of the things I've been very vocal about right now is that the only medical input they've been getting has been essentially from the chief medical officer of health and that office, which is seconded underneath the government, which is not connected and is basically removed. So even as the rep of all the eMERGE docs in the province, I can't even get to, you know, Dr. Hinshaw and her team to try to advise what's going on. So it's beyond dysfunctional and broken. And I think they just stuck to their political ideology and just chose to ignore us. And I'll tell you, I'll be very clear. Lots and lots and lots of Albertans have died because of that.
Well, I was actually saving that question for later in the show, but I'm glad that you said it, because that's where I'm at. Like, early, it's like, okay, you can have a debate about whether, you know, world policy that was being enacted generally worldwide, whether we can blame specific jurisdictional governments for those mistakes. But eventually, like, there's no way around that our best summer ever open for summer plan killed people.
No question.
It just did. Like, you can't, it's no longer, you know, and so we've talked about whether that should be criminal on this show, but again, that's for other people to decide at some point down the road. Dr. Vipond, pretty hardcore, has been calling for Dr. Dina Hinshaw's resignation. Do you have a personal opinion on that, or are there lots of doctors, without giving names or whatever, like, are starting to form opinions on this same thing?
Yeah, so two pieces there I'd be extremely clear about is I don't think I have any animosity for the person. Dr. Hinshaw, I think I have no doubt, has worked insanely hard and has been trying her best and working very hard. But the role and the interpretation of the role of the chief medical officer, I think there's a very wide consensus in the medical profession that piece is broken. So as an example, I'll give you an example, is the fact that it's seconded under the government, and Dr. Hinshaw has publicly said that her only job is to advise the government. And so there's two pieces that are wrong with that. I think the act actually says that she can act and do things and doesn't have to actually do what the government says necessarily, if it's in the best interest of public health. But the bigger piece there is Albertans and the medical profession, we have no clue what she's been advising. So we don't know what our own medical officer of health has advised, for example, around masking in schools, say, or around, you know, any of the suggestions around restrictions. All we know is that was advised behind closed doors. And then the political process occurred and then policy came out of there. But so I think the medical profession is quite a strong consensus that that piece is definitely broken. And that's probably why there's calls for her resignation or for a change in how that reporting and how that structure is done. And so, you know, I'll give you a really, that sounds all nebulous. Here's a really easy example. In the summer, they declared the pandemic over and they decided that they were going to stop community testing for COVID. And not a single eMERGE doc in anywhere in Alberta Health Services or in front lines was aware of this, knew they were going to do this. And as soon as we heard this, we're like, well, everyone's going to flock to the eMERGE departments to get COVID testing. Have you guys even thought of that? And there was no way to even get that. So I went up the chain as high as you could in AHS and through AMA and trying to get to the government. And they were like, they didn't have a clue about that. And there was no way for us to even, you know, advise on that and tell them how disastrous that'd be. You'd be sending all these kind of sick or not sick patients overwhelming our eMERGE departments just to get testing. Well, that happened right in July while we were trying to get all this going. And we had no ability to influence that, or we didn't even know it was coming. AHS didn't know. Nobody knew that was going to be either did she advise that or was the government going to actually implement that? That's how broken this system is. And that's where our concerns are, like big time.
This last week, a couple weeks ago, maybe you penned a letter to Premier Jason Kenney, a new Alberta Health Minister, Nathan Copping. That's the name, right?
Jason Copping. Jeez, you're thinking Jason, Nathan
yeah.
Cooper.
Nathan Cooper. Yeah. So anyways, yeah. Health Minister Jason Copping, one of the many Jasons that we have in our province. Anyway, you invited them to visit an Edmonton ICU to kind of see what was going on. And they, as we all knew they would, vaguely denied without directly responding to you. And we had that story in our newspaper. We've sent our newest reporter, Kendall King, your way a few times lately. So you guys are starting to probably build a professional relationship. But my question is, if you were taking Jeremy and Mo and I on a tour of an ICU right now, what would we see? We all think we know what we see. We obviously acknowledge on this show that it's busy and it's hard. But can you give us a little bit of a detailed description of what a tour would be like if we said, yeah, we'll come?
Yeah, I mean, and that's why I wish we could, you know, bring the cameras in and show Albertans, because honestly, that's where there's been a huge disconnect of, you know, business as usual everywhere out in Alberta outside of the hospitals and what we're seeing in the hospitals. So if we brought you in now and took you to, you know, you'd see an overflowing ICU where every single one of our rooms that's designed for one patient has two in it. So we've got stretchers side by side in a single room. These are very, like, every single patient's on a ventilator with multiple lines and drips. And every 2 hours, they need to be flipped from their back onto their front, which is really complicated, which is something that's called proning. And we didn't do that a lot in ever before, but COVID's changed that because basically we're trying to change where the gravity in the lungs are to recruit more of the lungs. But you're going to see then that's the entire main ICU. And you're going to see one nurse is kind of scrambling to take care of three or four patients when normally they would be one to one. You're going to hear, nurses now giving instructions to, say, like obstetrics and gynecology or eMERGE nurses that are there to help out because they don't necessarily aren't ICU trained, but because they're so overwhelmed, we're transferring any type of nursing that we can get that has some critical care skills to help them out. And then from there, you're going to see families that are in rooms that can't even get in to see their loved ones. So they're actually just basically Zooming and FaceTiming is the best. But all of these patients are, almost all of them, are so heavily sedated and battling with the other things that you don't think about with COVID. So like huge pressure ulcers and other infections and all that kind of care that it takes to take care of someone that's essentially in a medical coma on a ventilator. And that's just the ICU. Then we're going to march you to the basement of the hospital where we have our overflow ICU. And we have actually squished beds and in some spots, baby monitors to alert us of alarms down the hall because it wasn't designed for this. I'm not joking. I'm taking a baby monitor to listen to the alarms for so the nurses can be warned if a ventilator, for example, all these people on ventilators, if it becomes disconnected or blocked or any trouble, then they're not breathing. And we have to be immediately able to respond to that and fix that. If obviously someone on a ventilator was not looked after for a while and that happened, they could die, right? So all those things that I'm showing you, that's just the kind of the what's happening in the ICUs. And then we'll march you over to our COVID wards. And our COVID wards are like overflowing with very, very sick people that normally would be in our ICUs, but they can't get in there because their ICUs are full. And you'll see one nurse kind of scrambling to take care of six patients on those wards. And so that picture is what we're dealing with every single day in all of our hospitals in the province. And that's what people need to see to just get a glimpse of why we're saying, like, you know, 173 beds is our ICU capacity in the province. We've stretched it to 370. The efforts and the things, and we've just basically MacGyvered it in order so we could do that. That's what people have to understand. Like, someone's like, yeah, I can hear people out there saying, what the heck, the baby monitors and stuff. It's like, that's the best we can do right now. That's what we're doing to keep people alive. And that's why we're saying to everybody, listen, if you get in a car accident or if you get a heart attack or if you get something even non-COVID, if you're lucky, you're going to get thrust into that kind of environment on top of it if you need critical care, if there's space for you. So it's, you know, it's just beyond suboptimal, and it's everyone's trying their absolute best, but it's just people would be shocked to see what our regular ICU kind of care is like now.
And obviously the COVID situation down in Medicine Hat is especially dire, or at least was until recently. But I take it that these conditions aren't confined to the hospital in Medicine Hat. And, you know, I'm sure you alluded to before, you socialized with other physicians elsewhere in the province. Have they told you similar horror stories?
Oh yeah. In fact, I should make very, very clear that's the picture I'm painting for every single one of our hospitals. Okay. So yeah, you know, that, like, even in Calgary and Edmonton have bigger hospitals and bigger infrastructure. So they're able to do their expansion a bit better. And so there's different challenges at each of the different hospitals, but 100%, this is all emulated exactly the same in all the different hospitals. So I'll give you, like, just pick Red Deer. Red Deer at one point had, you know, 200% capacity of their ICU. Plus they had four or five, you know, near to dying patients on their wards. So an example is OptiFlow, we call it, but it's the highest flow oxygen that you would never in the past ever have anybody on it on our wards. They'd go to ICU because it's basically the step just before going on a ventilator. Now it's routine that in all of our hospitals across the whole province, we have very sick patients on OptiFlow as an example, that if they get any sicker, they'll crash code and need to be put on a ventilator. That's the kind of stuff we're dealing with in every one of the hospitals.
Now, on top of the fact that you are stressed to the limits with resources to take care of COVID patients, I think everybody can understand why I might ask this question, but you have other patients that are in the hospitals too. You know, I know thankfully my specific loved one has been moved to a rehab area of the hospital where she'll spend her time. But at one point she was essentially across the hall from a COVID ward. What kind of effort has to go into ensuring sort of COVID stays where COVID is and doesn't get to the other areas of the hospital? And how much strain is that putting on staff to ensure that those efforts are in place?
Yeah. And when, yeah. So I should always preface everything too about, it's always a balance because you're trying to picture, paint a picture to everybody of how disastrous and terrible it is. And it is, but we haven't been pushed to the brink where we're doing critical triage or we're letting people die. We're still helping people. And so I don't want to scare people away from coming to our hospitals if they're sick, because we can still care for them. But the big but is it's a huge effort, like for us to wear all of our PPE and for us going in and out of rooms takes 5 minutes longer for every patient now, you know, those kind of, and then cohorting and doing more tests so that we keep the people with COVID in specific areas and try to have no intermingling with the other patients and the staff, try to keep them from moving from COVID units to non-COVID units. And even in our merge, for example, trying to kind of, as soon as we identify that someone is possibly even remotely a chance that they may have COVID, we isolate them until we get tests back and confirm. So it just adds layers and layers of steps that we have to do, which just slows everything down. And it just is more time consuming, and it's very different from what we're normally used to be doing. So it just adds a layer of complexity. But for the most part, you know, now, especially you hear about outbreaks and things like that, but for the most part, now that we're operating in the full fourth wave, we operate under the assumption basically that everybody has COVID. So it's a bit more safer that way, because now you won't accidentally interact with someone and then go to someone else and then later realize that first person had COVID. We're treating it like everybody does, essentially, so that protects people.
When you're stretched to the limit on equipment, everybody can understand this idea that, like, you know, you're in rooms that aren't ready for this. You're having to use baby monitors. So we have the resource limit. There's no doubt. Capacity limit, insane, right? Every time you stretch the beds to make more beds, you're taking beds from other areas. I mean, you're not making ICU beds, right? We're stretching everything. So that doesn't even take into account that, like, people get tired. You know, if I'm not well rested, a lot more likely that I'm going to accidentally forget the L in public in a headline or something like that in the newspaper, right? It's a lot more likely that 11,000 people read something that screws up. Right? Anybody that's tired or has a long day or trying to do more than they would normally do with less than they normally have to do it, fatigue starts to set in where are we at? And the quality of product suffers. Where are we at in that process for people? And again, we're not trying to scare people away from hospitals, but surely to God, the staff dealing with these ICUs must be at a breaking point, some of them, as far as fatigue and ability to do it at the best level.
Yeah, no question. And so, I mean, I have to give a shout out to all my colleagues and everybody, because, you know, this has been 20 freaking months. Like, we've been working hard, and we still are working hard, and they're still showing up. But I'll tell you two things. Fatigue is absolute high. Absolutely. We're just fatigued. Here's some examples is that, you know, as soon as anybody gets exposed, they're out for 10 days or 14 days, depending, or if they get any symptoms. So all of a sudden now we've had it where it's very regular that nurses and doctors are having to double shift or take extra shifts because we just lose healthcare personnel to COVID exposure or COVID illness. So that's been happening lots and lots and lots. And then, of course, as soon as you get now for our nurses, for example, they're working 7 days a week. Sometimes they're now, obviously they've been acted where they actually have demands now that you can be forced to stay 4 hours past your shift. You can be forced to come in on your day off. Those are all being enacted because we're so desperately low of staff that
it's that or don't take care of people.
Exactly. Exactly. And so that's been happening routinely as well. And then you also now have because you're 20 months in, you got that fatigue of some very senior nurses have departed for other, they've gone, and I can't blame them, but they've gone from doing that critical care to say, you know what, I'd rather move out into the community and do vaccines or do something else, and I need a break. And they are leaving that workforce. And there's very few people that are wanting to sign up and join to be a nurse at this point in time, to fill that in. And of course, you know what, it takes 2 years to train a nurse to do critical care, right? Minimum, like actual 2 years of nursing, not nursing school. So all of that adds up. And then you add morale, you know, we're two pieces of the morale. Morale is really low because most of what we're seeing, 90% of what we're seeing is could be preventable. If they're all almost, you know, 90% are unvaccinated in the ICU and the really sick are unvaccinated. And so now we're seeing more and more of that. And so that's demoralizing because it's like, geez, like if these people weren't misinformed and if we hadn't gone down this crazy rabbit hole of people being anti-vax or being vax hesitant, we wouldn't have this. And then we are getting that small percentage of people that are abusing healthcare staff. They're, you know, like directly coughing and spitting on nurses or yelling at them or verbally abusing them.
Directly coughing or spitting, that's actually criminal assault, is that not?
It is. It is. And of course, AHS is trying to deal with that I'm not making this up. This is some of the stuff that's happening, you know. So that thankfully is rare. So I'll tell you, my experience and a lot of my colleagues is of the unvaccinated, you know, there's probably of the portion that are unvaccinated, probably 80% are in that group of like they're hesitant or they've been misinformed or they're leery and they don't really know. But then there's the 10, 15, somewhere in there percent that are just, you know, staunch, so far gone anti-vax that they won't even accept that they have COVID, for example, and their families won't, and they won't, they're not thankful and they're not kind to our nurses. And it's something that beats up on the nurses. You know, you take an exhausted nurse and whip them a bit more. It's not a good thing. Right. So
how do you personally deal with the burnout you must face having to deal with this like all day, every day?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little tough too, because of course I put myself out there to advocate and try to get the government to listen to us on top of it. So it's like I go home from my shift and then I get to talk about this crap and try to get the government. No. And you know what? And I get it. And the reason it's important is so you know what? Part of it is I have to mentally tell myself two things that I don't blame the misinformed, but I do have anger and frustration for the people who are spreading the misinformation. And so I'm very frustrated about that and very frustrated about the very small percentage of doctors who are actually doing that too and misinforming and things like that. I think it's criminal and I think it's totally unprofessional and just terrible. So I have to remind myself that piece is that it's not the people that have been misled, it's the people doing the misleading. And then the other part is I just have to hope that if we can advocate and kind of, you know, get the government's attention and get people's attention, like I do feel frustrated that the government is signaling to Albertans, don't worry about the pandemic. It's not too bad. Don't really worry. And while we're trying to make everybody aware that you should be worried about it and you should be changing your behaviors a little bit because it is bad.
Well, it's not even just the provincial government, just throw in as, you know, elections are coming up. The mayor of Medicine Hat did say in June, and I quote, some people are still afraid of COVID-19 for whatever reason. So anyways, there's a lot of people that are in positions of authority or power that spread information. I'm an advocate as a journalist that we shouldn't necessarily ask the opinion of the elected official on every single goddamn subject out there, but that I digress. You said something a couple minutes ago and my brain, if I get confused on something, I get stuck on it, but you brought up COVID exposure for healthcare staff. My brain's telling me anyone that goes into one of those double bedded ICU rooms is immediately exposed to COVID. So what constitutes COVID exposure for a healthcare worker where they would actually now have to leave the ward and go isolate versus the healthcare staff that are literally touching COVID patients all day, every day?
Yeah, well, and so, you know, that's less of an issue now because we're just basically treating everybody as if they're full on COVID, for example, right? But so where you'll get those exposures. So you're right. So on the ICU, no, I mean, you're going to get a breach of your PPE or certain things like that. Thankfully, the two things, the way that we mitigate that is to try to maximize as many of our healthcare to have vaccines. And then rapid testing and confirmation of symptoms. And so there's a small risk of that dealing with the really, really sick COVID patients. but less so because we're mentally prepared and that's, we're using our PPE and we're being cautious. But the bigger is that, you know, so I'll give you examples. I mean, in the last couple of weeks, I've had patients come in with, say, symptoms of an appendicitis and low grade fever, and they end up examining like an appendicitis, and they have an appendicitis, get a CT up. Yes, their appendix, but well, we should swab them as well just to make sure. And they're COVID positive. So if that patient had gone to the OR and maybe people were a little less lax because they're thinking, well, this is just an appendix and nothing related to COVID, then that could have been an exposure to the whole OR staff and the docs and everybody in the operating room. And again, I want to say that we try to mitigate that by treating everything like it's possibly COVID. And we are actually testing everybody almost now when they're getting admitted to hospital for those reasons. But prior to a couple of weeks ago, when those numbers, you know, a month ago or so, that those kind of breaches were happening more frequently.
I was going to say that this is I have a question, but this is for an epidemiologist possibly, but you talk about somebody that comes into the, you know, with an appendicitis and they end up getting swabbed and sure enough, they have COVID. Do you have an idea of this, like any sense of how much of that really is happening and how many people are wandering around with this virus that don't know it?
I mean, I can't give you numbers, but it's way higher than you think. So a couple things we know of. Two things, you know, so Delta's different. Delta's a different beast. So now more and more people get odd symptoms, GI. So like diarrhea, nausea, vomiting is like a way more common types of symptoms than just the respiratory cough, runny nose that people think of with COVID. But there's also societal wise, again, it probably goes to how our government's really misinformed and misled our people, is that now we're in a position where more and more people are having mild to moderate symptoms and not getting tested. And that's intentional choice that they're doing that. And the way we know that is our admission rates kind of doubled. So our hospital admission rate from previous waves went almost double, because essentially what that means, it's not that Delta's twice as bad and more people have to get admitted. It's that we know for a fact, basically, that we're only touching the people that get sick and come into hospital and then we test them. They're only coming in and getting tested once they're sick enough to need that. So we know the percentage of people out in the communities that are carrying COVID and may have mild to moderate symptoms and not tested positive or not got tested is a lot higher than we think. And so again, that's why I can't stress enough why, with our numbers and our transmissibility and what we're seeing in our province, why we have to have everybody vaccinated, why people still need to wear masks even when they're vaccinated, and why we gotta, you know, I'll tell you. So this is me personally speaking, but even as a professional, like, how the hell can we have like thousands of people at hockey games and concerts, but you can't have more than two families at Thanksgiving dinner? Like, how does that make sense? Like, it's baffling.
To me, it seems like just like any time else in this pandemic, they feel like certain measures just make them look like they're doing something, like the 10 p.m. liquor curfew. Like, with all due respect, and like, it's funny because our listeners don't know that you have some a little craft beer connection too that we'll plug at the end of the show. But This has affected you all over the place. But what a stupid goddamn rule when you're trying to limit the spread of a virus here. Like, every time that they've had the thing that they should do in front of them with people like yourself, like Dr. Gosha Gasparovitz from the UFC, like Dr. Joe Vipond, who's all saying what you should do, they ignore it to go do something else that gives the impression that they've done something that everybody knows from minute one isn't going to do squat, such as, like I said, 10 p.m. liquor curfews, or like you're saying, limiting your Thanksgiving contacts or whatever. Like, I mean, at this point, everybody understands that, like, we can't just live the pandemic life forever. We have the vaccine, and eventually once everybody's able to get vaccinated, we know they're going to go back to the world. Like, we know we're going to go live among each other again. But experts have been asking for it to delay because, you know, kids can't get vaccinated yet. All of these various, 70% of everyone else is not even close to enough people to avoid real problems, right? So I can't even really remember where I was going with that. I was just on a rant, but
but that's kind of how I feel too.
You talk about these things so freaking often and you're like, you just can't believe it. Now, like, I guess what bothers me the most about what where we're at right now is not obviously that it's happening, but this is the thing that we told people that we were trying to avoid, and it still hasn't sort of jarred people to doing the right thing. That's what I was talking about, vaccine passports. So now we have to fucking make them, right? Like, there's only one way around this. Like, none of these half-assed curfew measures. Like, you're either getting vaccinated or you don't get to be part of our fun anymore, right?
Yeah, well, you know what? And you're right. Like, and that's so, two things you've made me think during your long-winded question there. No, it's all good. I'm joking. The one was that, so, you know, those doctors you mentioned, I mean, I'm part of the Protect Our Province, Alberta, where it's like so pathetic that we as physicians have to, you know, go do, you know, daily press releases so we can tell people, you know, what the government should be telling them and giving them the data and giving them some real facts. But for example, the passport, it's insane. So here's the thing. Yes, we need it. And yes, it has to be like something that's meaningful. Like, it has to be, we're at the point now where, you know, the government keeps on saying that they don't want to punish the vaccinated and the people that are doing the right things. That's, of course, that's, I don't want that either. So if you make a vaccine passport that's meaningful enough that it's difficult for people to do, you know, anything, everything outside of the exact bare, like bare essentials, if you make it difficult, that's going to make people go get vaccinated. We know that. We know that. And so, to put out an unprotected PDF that a 10-year-old can put their name on it and then show that they're vaccinated, even though 10-year-olds can't get vaccinated, like, it's insane. It's stupid. Like, it's the people, Albertans should be like totally pissed off by that. They should be like, this is like, you guys aren't even trying. Like, if this was a high school project, we'd fail you for that. But I have no doubt that if we did it in a meaningful way with some, you know, it couldn't be falsified QR codes, the government enforced it and helped small businesses or big businesses or whoever help them implement it, lots and lots of people would go out and get vaccinated because they'd be like, okay, that hesitancy I had and this stuff I was worried about, this is impacting my life so much that I'm going to go out and do the right thing, even though maybe I should have done it without the restrictions. But this government hasn't even really tried. Like, they honestly have not really tried. And then the last piece I would add there, it's insane for me to hear the government say that they don't really want to do it either because, you know, then they'll have to enforce it. And, you know, and the bad people out there are going to still keep being bad, or the unvaccinated aren't going to follow the rules. It's like, come on, like, isn't that the entire job of the government, is to actually enforce the laws that keep people safe? Like, that would be like saying, you know, we're not going to put out drunk driving laws out there because the drunks are going to still keep on driving. Like, it's crazy.
That's why I have long been a proponent of there being no laws at all.
Right. There you go.
People are just going to violate them. So you might as well just not have any. I wanted to ask you though, you mentioned the vaccine passport and how easily falsifiable it is. Do you think that was intentional on the government's part? Because it seems like a pretty huge oversight. And I realize that this is sort of beyond your expertise, but like, you're a smart guy. And what do you think?
I think at a minimum, they didn't even give it a college try. Like, honestly, come on. Were they intentionally? So, you know what? I don't get it, because they've so often made decisions where it's they're not pleasing anybody when they do it, right? So if they're going to put out the passport, sure, some X number of their base is going to be pissed off because they've never wanted a passport or any government kind of interventions. But of course, everybody that would be, whatever the percentage would be, wanting a meaningful passport is going to be pissed off by what they did too, because they didn't even try to get it right. So it's almost like they're intentionally trying to make everybody unhappy. And it just, and of course, the end why I'm here and talking to you guys about it is because, what they're doing ends up translating into 20, 25 deaths a day. Like said, so in September, we've had like almost, I don't know the exact number. I've seen so many numbers. And so, but you know, 460, 470 deaths in September. Like,
yeah,
it's crazy.
Yeah. It was a lot. Well, yeah. I mean, our worst month for death was still January. In this pandemic, I think we lost like 1,000 between like in that second wave between middle of December and the end of January, but we had no vaccine at the time. Right. Mm-hmm. And, it was just sweeping through our senior community.
Yeah.
This one's obviously going, quite a bit younger this time. And we all know the numbers that a lot closer to our age, my age, I should say 44, Jeremy's age 30, starting to get sick. Yep. You talked about vaccines among healthcare staff. I have a couple of things I wanted to talk to you about, because anytime you talk to the anti-vaxxers or whatever, that at least think they're smart, they like to say that, talk about the healthcare professionals that are anti-vaccine passport. And, you know, you hear about this person quits and that person quits or whatever. You mentioned you hope as many healthcare staff as possible can be vaccinated. And then we also had the 80, Mo might know the number, 70 some or 80 some doctors across the province that wrote a letter, including our own Dr. Bodang, who has been anti-restrictions this whole time. Question being, does that bug you more than any other the information when your own colleagues are helping to perpetuate misinformation?
Yeah, for sure. It makes me livid, actually, because there's a couple pieces in there. One is that people have to understand, Albertans have to understand, you know, if it's 73 or 75 of that signed that letter, there's 11,000 doctors. So you really, you know, I put that in the analogy of it's like the 1 in 100 dentists that say brushing your teeth is bad for you. Like, it's just, that's what we're talking about here. But here's the thing that I would say to those colleagues too, is that they've got the science wrong and they kind of know it, but they're intentionally misleading. Because so, you know, what's happening is that a lot of them on there are taking a stance strongly against any right of the government to implement, you know, restrictions on them or to force, you know, certain things on their personal body, like making them get a vaccine. So they're against that. And there may be some valid discussion that people can have about whether that's okay or not, or whether the pandemic and things justify doing that. And that's a different discussion, though, than what a lot of them are doing, where they're trying to make it sound like the science isn't sound, and that the science around the vaccines isn't proven or it's not safe, to bolster their argument about their personal liberty. And that's what's making me the most frustrated and mad, is that misinformation out there. And they're wrong. Like, they're so far offside. And, you know, so Dr. Dang is like a good example of that. He did the same thing a year ago about masks, and actually told our city hall. So our mayor invited just him, didn't invite myself or any other leaders in the community to discuss the masks. And he gave them totally wrong scientific information, has since said and recanted some of the things about what he said about the masks. But his concern was around, you know, can the government force people to have masks? So my point is that, yes, it makes me livid that professionals out there are lending some credence to this idea that science isn't sound, when that is absolutely not true. And the vaccines. And so I support it. The other part, if you wanted to get in the argument about individual liberty versus society, I tell you, like, we live in a society. So sometimes there has to be restrictions and there has to be limitations on your individual liberties to protect the greater good of society. So you could have that debate and have a whole podcast about that, mm-hmm. but there's no debate about the science.
Well, I mean, we've certainly talked about this. Like, if nobody friggin' wanted to wake up in a world where all of these things that we're doing, this mitigation now, is necessary. At no point did anyone in North America that I know of stand up and say, hey, what we need to do is have make people get a shot of something that they don't want to get necessarily, right? Like, obviously, that's not, nobody wanted that, but that is that's our reality. And our problem in 2021, and it's not just COVID, it's climate, it's freaking anything, it's poverty, it's anything else. We have leaders whose reaction to reality is to wish it didn't exist. Well, it'd be cooler if that wasn't here. Well, okay, yeah, it would be. The pandemic is here, though, and it's causing a humongous problem. And, like, wishing that it, like, oh, shucks, this sucks, is for the people to do. You need to do something about it. Like,
yeah, I agree. Totally. And you know what I'll tell you is that, you know, it should be clear, like, none of my colleagues, like all these doctors you see out there advocating me, I'm sure I'm getting I don't even read the comments on social media stuff anymore. I'm sure that I'm getting lots of hate. I mean, haters gonna hate, I get that, but the point is, like, it should be clear to everybody, I don't want restrictions, I don't want vaccine passports, and I don't want like, this isn't my desire that everybody get forced vaccines. It's the reality of where we're at. And I land on the side of, I don't want innocent Albertans to just keep dropping like flies and dying. And I don't want our healthcare system to get to the point where I can't take care of your mom and dad because they're in a car accident.
Right.
That's my job. That's what I want to do. So I'm weighing those balances and saying, yes, that sucky restrictions and vaccines and those pieces are more important to implement and then to let our system and our healthcare system collapse and let people die. That's, you know, that's the end result. Like, I don't want to be the face of telling people they can't go to an Oilers game. Like, I don't want that, but I'm in that position because you guarantee you go to 20,000 people in that Oilers game and you're going to increase your risk of getting COVID and die.
Yeah. And this is the thing, like, I don't know. It's one of those things where it's kind of like throwing a lung cancer warning on a cigarette package, right? You can show the almost dead lungs in a picture form all you want. Like, people's brains don't compute sort of that future problem with the action today. And they just, I mean, I've had conversations with buddies that I hope are vaccinated now that they had no choice, but at the time weren't going to, and were kind of like, well, I'm healthy, I don't get sick. Yeah, well, you will this time, buddy. You know, like, it's not, we're not messing around. Like, you're not talking about the common cold here anymore. Like, it's, so yeah, to keep people alive, sometimes you actually have to, like, tell them, like, this is the law. And when it has to do with, not only are we trying to keep you alive, but we're trying to keep you from killing other people, your choice is now, you don't get that choice anymore. That's that's what freedom is. You're not free to be so ignorant and negligent that people around you die, including yourself. That's not what freedom is. And it's not what we've ever aspired for freedom to be. That's literally anarchy.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And I mean, of course. And you know, it's like, people are not very good at judging risk. Like you said, your buddies that are like, I'm healthy and I, you know, so I don't really need the vaccine because I'm 40 and I'm going to be fine. Right. But you know, I just saw a recent, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it was something like just Alberta. It's something like one in 2,500 non-vaccinated Albertans are in ICU right now. One in 2,500 are in ICU right now, versus it's about one in 100,000 double vaccinated are in ICU right now. I mean, those it's mind, you know, boggling to even think that people would be like, yeah, I'll take that risk. I'll go one in 2,000 ish that I'll get, you know, a life altering stay in ICU where that if I live, I'll be debilitated and have scars and damage for the rest of my life. And maybe even I'll die. Like, why would people take that risk? I don't think they understand what the risk really is.
That's my goal really right now, is to have people start understanding the size of these numbers. Like, there are people that just think 68 Medicine Hatters is not a big number. There are people that think 3,000 Albertans dead isn't a big number. Well, there's 4.5 million of us. Only 3,000 died, and we fucking sat around for 20 years with all this, or 20 months with all this yada, yada, yada. You know?
Yeah.
Never mind the fact that had we done it correctly the first time and continued to keep restrictions in place until the R value got us into an actual endemic as opposed to pandemic, we might not be in this mess. Those 3,000 people not only wouldn't have died, but you wouldn't have gone through 20 months of having to live like this. So doing the half-ass, not taking care of the problem is why it's taking so long. And now we're royally fucked because our hospitals are legitimately screwed. you know?
Yeah.
So I guess my last question for you today, and I'll would be about where we're at right now, because once again, our peak at the just over 20,000 in the province, and we got to holy shit, like just under 700 in Medicine Hat. We are seeing an active case drop. The hospital drop hasn't gone yet. It should be noted that ICU totals in Alberta actually climbed yesterday. But people are going to look at the trend. People are going to see in Medicine Hat that 470 or whatever it is now isn't 699 anymore. Are these numbers that we're seeing, what does that mean for your world? How long till your world follows those numbers? And is this something that we can see as a light at the end of the tunnel on this, or what?
Yeah, well, you have to be hopeful. So I think the evidence shows us right now we've plateaued for sure. As to whether that plateau is going to start to drop, which is what we need, versus are we going to get a little spike on top of this plateau, which would be terrible. That's going to be a little bit of time is going to tell. So the biggest thing I would say is people should not be letting their guard down now. People have to understand that that plateau also means that we probably got 2 to 4 weeks of real severe pain in our healthcare system, because all those the 1500, simple math, the 1500 on Friday say that we're tested positive. In there, it's going to be about 75 are going to need to be hospitalized, about 25 are going to need to go into the ICU, and probably all comers of that 1500, probably about 25 are going to die. And that's from Friday. We won't see that until 2-3 weeks from now. So all that lag, we've got 2 to 3 weeks of lag that we're, and also Albertans have to know, we've only plateaued for our ICU because people are kind enough to die. I mean, it's really sad to say that, but our numbers have held okay because people are dying to make room for more people to go into our ICU. So I would just say like two things. We're not out of the woods, so people don't let your guard down, wear masks, be careful, avoid big crowds if you can, those kind of things. But everyone that's not vaccinated, get vaccinated, because we're going to go into I don't know what's going to happen with our bump from Thanksgiving, but I'm also worried that as soon as we start to get some cold weather, we're already seeing this in Emerge, for example, that RSV is a respiratory virus for kids. We're seeing cases of RSV now quite regularly, which is indicative that kids are in school mingling and spreading around illness. And it's a winter respiratory virus. It basically comes out every time in the winter because everyone's indoors and it's cold and it spreads easier that way. Well, that's the worry as we head into winter. If this plateau doesn't come down before we have any other winter kind of spikes or stuff, we could be in trouble. So long-winded way of saying, don't let your guard down. Like, people need to understand that there's probably a good 4 to 6 weeks of pain and at least that amount of time to see which way things are going to go.
What we have coming, unfortunately, and super terrifyingly still, is the first child to die, right? Like, that yep. is, I see that as an inevitability. I have talked to other doctors who seem to think that. Do you agree? Like, this is a matter of time, really, only until we see an unvaccinated kid.
Yeah, so, you know, it's like I said, I hate sounding like doom and gloom, but a lot of this is doom and gloom. But like I said, people don't understand risks and odds and percentages, but it's just a numbers game. If there's, don't anybody challenge me on the exact numbers, I'm using rough ones, but if there's 600,000 kids in Alberta or whatever the number is, even a small percentage that get critically ill and then die, it's just a numbers game. It's going to be, even if it's 0.01%, we're going to see more. We already are seeing more and more kids need to get hospitalized because of this. And then everybody always throws in the comorbidity crap. Like, people have to stop that. Like, people that are, you know, so good colleagues of mine, I won't say where to protect confidentiality, spent 2 hours coding a 30-year-old and they didn't resuscitate him and he died from COVID. And he had no comorbidities. He was well. He was a healthy 30-year-old male with kids. So there just is going to be, as more kids get COVID, as at whatever the small percentage that need to get hospitalized, in that percentage, there is going to be some that will get deathly ill and die. It's just a matter of fact. And it's what we want to avoid, and what none of us want to hear about, and again, you know, everyone can say, well, maybe it's only going to be one or two, but if you had young kids, would you want it to be your kid that's the one or two? Nobody would. No one would volunteer for that.
Well, and I mean, again, yeah, it's bringing up doom and gloom, and yeah, these episodes can be hard to listen to, but again, reality is reality. We're in a crisis. Like, you don't get to just like, oh, remember the good old days? Yeah, but yeah, 2019 was great, but it's not here anymore, and this is actually happening to us. So if we don't, you know, it's the people that see these realities that look away. They're like, oh, it's too negative. I'm in the newspaper business, so obviously I see negative news all the time. I can't stand that excuse for like, oh, it's too negative, it's too terrible. Yeah, fuck, man, exactly, it is. It's terrifying. It's terrifying.
Yeah, a pandemic is a really, really bad thing. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a bad thing.
We didn't even touch on, like, we probably canceled 100,000 scheduled surgery, 10,000 scheduled surgeries already in Alberta. So, like, there's a lot of people out there that have real impact and are suffering because of this shit. Like, it's bad. Like, it's not, there's nothing really good. I've said this tons. There's nothing good about this freaking pandemic. Like, it's all bad. It's just, can we mitigate it, right?
Well, yes. And there's varying degrees of bad. And we, as I said, a whole other podcast as well, but we have given so much equal or better opportunity to the impact of the economy than we have to the impact of real human suffering and lives. And that's one of the biggest tragedies of this entire pandemic, is this idea that those two things matter on the same level. And I think when my gut hurts for not only the family of the first kid that dies, but the nurse that has to watch that happen. I don't know how you can continue your career even when this pandemic's over if those are the kinds of sights that you're gonna see. And so I want to say a thank you so much for coming on the show. Voices like yours have helped us get through these times, and it's so heartening to have somebody in Medicine Hat in this forgotten corner where sometimes we get a reputation for being a certain way, and there are a lot of good people fighting for a lot of good things in this town, and you're one of them. Before we go though, I already brought it up, we gotta mention some Hell's Basement. We gotta talk a little craft beer for a couple of seconds. People, we'll do Mo's job for a second, but those of you who are thinking about taking a trip in this you can't go very far world, come down to Medicine Hat and check out some of our great craft breweries, but start with Hell's Basement. Am I right, Dr. Parks?
Yeah, you're right. I got my swag on here right now, even people won't see it, but for sure. I mean, there have to be some joys in this world, right? So come have a good beer. And yeah, exactly. And yeah, then of course, once we get through this, then come have a beer with friends and you sit on our patio and let's get back to normal times. Yeah, we all want that.
So what's your relationship with Hell's Basement?
I'm one of the owners. There's four of us. And so I'm one of the owners, and I put my blood, sweat, and tears into it. We're 5 years old this summer.
So, you guys are kind of the OG, right? Like, you guys beat Bruco, you beat like, you're the first, right? Yep. You're the initial, let's get this place up and running, right?
Yeah, I'd imagine best, but I'm obviously biased. But
I'd imagine a lot of your time now is consumed by hospital work and not brewing. But
yeah, I'm pretty absent from the business the last little while. But we got a couple of my other partners are obviously, one of them's a GM, and he's keeping her afloat. I mean, you know what? So and in seriousness, I'll tell you, that's part of where you kind of closed about the false dichotomy with the government. I'll tell you that the government's made it sound like they can only do, you know, lockdowns and health or support businesses. If they can't do both, it's like bullshit. It's like, you know, every single patient that's admitted in Alberta to our ICU costs about $51,000 a stay. Think of the money Alberta could have put in to support small businesses and, you know, craft breweries or restaurants or all these businesses that are suffering. the government could have put in meaningful restrictions and then supported those businesses, right? So yeah, and so my business, our brick hop brewery, we're struggling, we're surviving and doing okay. And so I feel the pain of small businesses. I know what they're going through. So it's just bullshit that the government has made it sound like it's one or the other.
Well, and then those of us that advocate for health are apparently anti-business somehow, which is just a load of shit. But that's the one thing I get accused of more than anything else in Medicine Hat is how I'm not pro-business. I'm like, I don't think you actually are reading clearly what I'm saying all the time. But nonetheless, you guys are heroes, not just you yourself, but your colleagues and everything you guys are doing. Believe me, I speak from a personal perspective right now. Like, I appreciate everything you guys are doing to keep people safe in that hospital. It means goddamn everything to my family right now. And it means a lot to a lot of families across Alberta that you guys continue to do this at a time when, good God, if you guys quit and couldn't take it anymore. We're all applauding a hockey goaltender right now for taking some time for some mental health, which is a wonderful thing as well. But I can't believe that how much you guys are going through. And I sure hope that when the supports are needed for you, that they're available. Thank you so much for coming on our show today. He is at PF Parks on Twitter. We'll put some stuff in the show notes. Do follow him, pay attention, guys. He's a huge voice out there. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, guys.
It's that time in the show where we like to thank those of our patrons who go way above and beyond anything we could ever hope for. To Darius Beauregard, thank you so much for your support. To Nicola DiNicola, thank you so much. To Big Red Machine, thank you so much. To Dave Bonmiller, thank you so much. And to Chris Derwolf, thank you ever so much for all you guys do for us. You guys are amazing. To our patrons and listeners beyond, you guys are also amazing. Thank you for joining us. Keep fighting the fight, guys. Everyone's tired. Everyone hates this shit. Obviously, we want to live in a world where we don't have to talk COVID every second episode too. But that world isn't here yet. We'll see you guys next week. Thank you to my co-host, Jeremy. Thank you to our producer, Mo Cranker. Love you guys. Peace.
Bye-bye. We'll be right back.